So welcome back to the Sisyphus 55 podcast. Today we're joined by Mackin Murphy. He's a researcher, writer, he's at University of Melbourne, and he is the current host of the Species podcast, which I would highly recommend checking out. But I think it would be better if you kind of talk a little bit about yourself and maybe explain how you got into this career path that's very multifaceted.
Yeah, myself, my favorite topic. So feel free to cut me off if I speak too much about this. I'm a PhD student at the University of Melbourne. I'm an Oxford graduate where I really focused on human mating behavior as part of their cognitive and evolutionary anthropology MSc. And then I studied the same sorts of topics when I was at Boston University. So I've been studying these topics for a long time. I'm now an active scientist, you know, running studies as we speak and, you know, finishing up others. Running one right now and then writing up another. That's kind of my relevant background. There's more I could say, but not much point in saying it.
Okay, cool. And was there something like personal that got you into this area of research, or were you just kind of generally curious about human mating behavior?
Yeah, everyone always asks that. It's like, if I was studying pigeons, nobody would be like, did you have a special encounter with a pigeon that led you to get super interested? It's like, it's an interesting topic. I mean, I drifted into it in the sense that I was originally interested in evolutionary psychology, right? Which is the most common way of understanding the human mind from an evolutionary perspective. I've lately shifted into different theoretical disciplines for reasons that aren't particularly important for the purposes of this show. But in terms of getting to the topic of human mating behavior specifically, I was originally very interested in violence, interpersonal violence. I thought that was just a fascinating topic. It's like, what's really going on there? And then I realized through just reading about it, it's like, oh, you know, violence evolves as part of intrasexual competition. Like that's one of the core functions of violence. It's not always the case, but even things like human warfare, right, are explicable, at least in their earliest, most basic stages, as reproduction relevant activity, right? And so it was really a shocking moment to come in contact with the truth, which is that so much of our behavior that seems unrelated to reproduction is actually directly pertinent to it. And from there, I began reading more, and then seeing more as well, just in my life, you know, having conversations with people and just recognizing that they were, you know, signaling to potential mates around us. Or, you know, in some cases, mate signaling to myself directly and just being like, oh, this is such a peculiar thing. Like, you know, I mean, there's so many things like that. And then also recognizing that different activities, why we do them, recognizing that a huge part of it is just reproduction relevant behavior. And many of the things that we find interesting and enjoy spending our time doing, it's just so much of it is mate signaling. I'm not saying that it all is, right? I know that a lot of the stereotype about scientists in my field is that we're just obsessed with sex and that's all we think about. And you know, maybe that's true to an extent, but it's really hard to exaggerate without going so far as saying, oh, everything is related to mating behavior. It's really hard to exaggerate how relevant this topic is to almost everything that you would want to talk about.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty famous George Carlin stand-up routine where he talks about all of war is pretty much like a dick measuring contest in terms of like literally the largest like weapons, largest bombs. It's all about size. But I am curious, like, how did they establish this link between reproductive signaling and like warfare and violence?
Warfare wouldn't be reproductive signaling. I apologize. Okay. I was speaking unclearly. Among chimpanzees, we see a phenomenon where, and I'm not saying that this is what current modern warfare or current post-industrial warfare is like, right? Again, I'm not someone who just says everything is relevant to reproduction. But what we see is we see that chimpanzees, our closest relatives, wage war over territory and resources. But the territory and resources, the reason they're waging war is because they want access to the mates who are on that territory. So you can think of it as like the fruits and resources and things like that, the foliage, etc., that attracts the females, and then the males live near the females, right? They want to be around them. And then another group of males in the other group says, hey, we actually want to increase our reproductive fitness here, so we're going to start assassinating the males of that group one by one. I mean, it's not a coincidence that when chimpanzees take to killing all of the members of the other group, they don't kill the females. I mean, this is a very unpleasant topic. It's not one that I necessarily want to speak about in detail today, but safe to say that our ancestral modes of warfare and even modern hunter-gatherer conflict often resembles this same pattern. It's obviously much more complex. Obviously, we're an extremely culturally sophisticated and intelligent species, and we use certain tools, but the basic pattern of trying to increase the number of mates that one has access to through warfare is it holds up. Like there was an instance of, I believe it was among the Yanomamo, where an anthropologist was explaining kind of modern's definitely the wrong word, was explaining post-industrial warfare and kind of its causes and consequences. And the Yanomamo man asked a question, something along the lines of, well, you know, are you going to steal their wives? Is that something that you guys are going to do? And they were like, no, what? We would never. Like, that's just not something that we don't want to, and we're not allowed to. And the response was, well, then why are you at war? Right? Like, what are you doing? Well, what's the point of the war? I believe that was the Yanomamo, and that probably comes from Napoleon Chagnon. So maybe take it with a grain of salt. But I would say that the basic theme holds up, that our natural mode of warfare is probably quite similar to that we see in our closest relative.
Just, I had like, I took just a few anthropology classes, but Chagnon, was he the one that a lot of anthropologists like accused him of kind of making that specific group seem like overly violent, or
that criticism probably holds up. I mean, you know, when you're writing an ethnography, right, there's a huge incentive to be flashy and interesting. But two things can be true at once. I mean, it's possible that the normal criticism isn't that he made them seem overly violent. The normal criticism is that he helped out. Like the real issue is that it seems, and I don't want to slander anybody, to be clear, this is like second and third hand information, so again, take it with a grain of salt. And we're really going back to a topic that I haven't thought about at all for years. So it's possible that the science here has changed and we no longer believe that human warfare is related to chimpanzee warfare. It's possible that everyone has changed their minds on that since I stopped reading about it. But I don't think so. I mean, I'd be surprised. The Chagnon accusation, the really bad one, is that he traded weaponry for information. And so he made their conflicts worse, right? By giving them steel axes and guns and being like, hey, I'll give you these if you can give me info. And then that gave them more leverage to be more violent, which helped his research. I mean, that's the accusation. I'm not saying that that's true, right? I'm not saying that that's true. I don't know. I just vaguely remember years ago that was an issue. But again, it's not like this is the only group that has intergroup conflict, right?
Maybe not universal, but it's consistently shown across groups.
Is that, yeah, and I'm not saying that all hunter-gatherer groups engage in conflict with other groups, but we do have records of hunter-gatherers engaging in conflict, and it does seem to show It's not like in post-industrial warfare. It's mm-hmm. different. It's its own thing. It's very interesting. And it does seem that we have, I wouldn't say an instinct for it, but we have some natural inclinations for war. And is it a coincidence? I mean, that's the other thing, is that a lot of, you know, social psychologists, cultural anthropologists types will say, you know, oh, our warfare is different. Our warfare is different. And it's like, well, it probably is different, but is it a coincidence that the only two species on Earth who do this are the most closely related? Right. Can you at least give me that it's like our closest cousin is the only other animal who does anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling me that there's no biological influence on warfare, that there's nothing there. Okay, cool. Great. I'm glad. I'm glad that, you know, you live in a universe where coincidences like that are so possible. I'm sure it's also coincidence that both of us have opposable thumbs, right? It's like when two species do something very peculiar and they're close relatives, it makes more sense to say that it evolved in the common ancestor instead of saying it evolved twice, right? Which, you know, I mean, maybe, because you could say the evolved twice is more reasonable, because it's like, well, they're starting from a similar baseline, and so they're maybe already close to that behavior, and so that's possible. But it's not really different, right? That's still, we're talking about biology. And then the other argument, that in one lineage it evolved, and then in the other lineage they made it up socially. It's like, okay, maybe we both made it up socially, right? By that same logic, it's like maybe we both just made it up as a behavior, and it's unnatural. Mm-hmm. And you know what? There actually are some groups of researchers who, you know, they hate this warfare stuff so much. Like, just so you know, like, it might be better to talk to other people about this, because this mm-hmm. is no longer my area of expertise. And it's also very controversial. Like, there's so much disagreement about this. But if you want to talk about it, I mean, there are some people who say that chimpanzee warfare is completely unnatural. And that it's a result of human contact. The evidence isn't great for that. It seems like my impression of the people who are on the other side of the warfare issue is that they're deeply personally bothered by the notion that there might be something natural about warfare. And I understand why, right? And again, I kind of hate that we're on this topic, because I know that so many people are going to misinterpret this in the comments. I'm not saying that war is good, right? I'm not saying war is inevitable. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying modern warfare is anything like the warfare of old, right? Or the warfare of groups that don't have, you know, post-industrial technology or access to that. I'm not saying any of those things. I'm just saying that group versus group conflict has deep roots in our evolution. The only other species that does it the same way we do it happens to be our closest relative, and it seems to be related to reproduction.
Well, I think that this is drifting into a conversation that might be a little bit more relevant to, I think, what you've recently been talking about, which is kind of the manosphere red pill area online, because those debates enter that kind of nature versus nurture argument at a much less academic level. And they do often make a lot of fundamental assumptions about dating and sex and reproductive strategies. And I'm kind of wondering, what are some fundamental assumptions that you see maybe correctly, or I would assume incorrectly, endorsed by, you know, male influencers on YouTube, TikTok, podcasts? I'm thinking kind of usually they're often called like the manosphere.
Yeah. I mean, they say a lot of stupid stuff. One thing related to the war, they say that women evolved to fall in love with their kidnappers because we have an evolutionary history of war. It's like, what a stupid thing to say. You have no evidence for that whatsoever. And then their argument, when you push them on it, when you're like, why did you say something so stupid? Because they say, oh, women evolved to fall in love with their kidnappers because we have a history of war. And I'm like, okay, you can't just say because we have a history of war. Why do you believe that? And they're like, oh, because women get over breakups sooner. And it's like, okay, well, that's not, number one, that's not good evidence, right? Even if that were true, that wouldn't evidence your very, like, when we talk about whether war is natural in academia, right? We would have like decades of debate tons of research, right? Tons of back and forth, right? There's a huge consequences to these sorts of ideas. And so it's really investigated quite rigorously. And they just offhand say that women evolve to fall in love with their kidnappers. I'm like, you're an idiot. And then they're talking about, the reason is because humans evolved to have war and because women get over breakups faster. And for what it's worth, it's like the evidence that women get over breakups faster, it's mixed. That's not something that you can just say is true, or that women have an easier time with breakups. It's like there's mixed evidence on that, actually, mate. I mean, there's a huge study. I believe it was 5,700 participants, 93 countries, where they looked at emotional consequences of breakups, and women had more severe consequences, right? So even that shred of evidence that they cling on to prove that what they call it their war brides theory, even that shred of evidence they cling to for their silly little idea, it doesn't hold up. So that's one example. But I could talk endlessly about things that the red pill gets wrong. And I'm not saying they get everything wrong, right? I mean, that's the other thing, is that people don't believe me when I say this, but I don't have, I just take facts one at a time. I mean, do I like the red pill personalities? No, I don't like the way they talk about women. I find them very unpleasant interpersonally. But I genuinely can separate that from the factual statements that they say. I'm totally willing to, you know, take a fact that they say and say, is this true or is it not? And if it's true, I just say it's true. Like, for example, they would say that beauty doesn't seem to be socially constructed, right? That there are universal beauty standards, right? And I would say, well, to an extent, on some traits, that's true. Like, for example, facial femininity is considered beautiful in every culture, right? But there are some traits where I would say that's not true. For example, BMI, right? Like women's BMI, if you ask a South African Zulu man, like, what's the most attractive BMI, and you give him a chart, he'll say someone relatively heavy, right? And in some cases, very heavy. Like the normal range goes up to 38 in terms of BMI, which is very obese. So he's like, that's a very attractive woman. If you speak to a Japanese man, an urban Japanese man, he'll typically say, and again, this is just the averages, right? There are obviously going to be Japanese men who prefer heavier women. There are obviously going to be South African Zulu men who prefer lighter women. But because of cultural and background ecological differences, right, immediate responses to the ecology, we see differences in mating preferences across cultures and across. You know, a Japanese man would generally prefer a much lighter woman than a man who, say, it's not just Zulu. I mean, we could also look at men who live in the Caribbean or parts of Thailand, right, where we see these preferences, or hunter-gatherer, or certain hunter-gatherer groups where they have a preference for larger mates. And so mating preferences, so it's like, yeah, beauty is partially socially constructed. There does seem to be a universal element to some beauty standards. And then other beauty standards seem to vary based on culture and ecology. So there are some things that I would say, I'd be happy to say that they're partially right. And there are some things that I'd be happy to say that they're just right about, although it's hard for me to, okay, here's something that they're just right about. They tell men, hey, if you want to be better looking and have more success with women, you should hit the gym. Right. That's good advice. No notes. That's fine. So I'm not just this crazy, like, blue pill bias. Like, I'm not like some of these other guys that you might see debating these blokes, where it's like they just want those guys to be wrong. That's really not how I approach issues. I just take facts one at a time and then assess the evidence. And if I don't know, I don't know. If I think it's right, I say why. And if I think it's wrong, I explain why as well.
What are your what's your sort of knowledge set in terms of the idea of, like, hypergamy, which is, that's usually one of, like, the fundamental kind of grounded assumptions made by these online personalities? Because I'm curious about that too.
Yeah. So hypergamy is the idea of marrying up, traditionally. That's not how they use it. So it's kind of worthless to just use the term, insist that the term is used that way. So let's just use the term the way they use it. Their use of the term is to argue that women date up, right? Whereas men date down and across, right? Women date up and across, men date down and across. It's like, all right, well, there's a few ways you could approach this. I would say that if you want to approach it correctly, you have to pick the variable on which you're dating up or across, and then measure that right? Like it would be very difficult to, it would be very difficult to have this conversation in a general sense. So if you pick status and education, right, it seems that people mostly mate across, right? If you pick wealth, it seems that women do tend to date up, but men also tend to make more money on average. So of course the average is going to be dating up. However, in addition to that, it is noteworthy that women have a strong preference, at least in the West and in other cultures as well, frankly, other capitalist cultures, where there's a preference towards males who make more money than themselves. So that would be an example where I would say, if you're talking about money, the preferences and behavior do seem to align, where women do seem to be quote unquote hypergamous. But if you're talking about looks, not really, right? And if you're talking about overall mate value, doesn't seem to be the case. However, I would say that women are much more picky than men in terms of mate selection. I think the old adage that, you know, I think it was Helen Fisher who said, women are looking for Mr. Perfect, men are looking for Mrs. Good Enough. And I think that holds up in practice. And what that results in is maybe the illusion of hypergamy, but it's just, you know, women's pickiness or relative choosiness, let's say. So, yeah, I mean, on hypergamy, the point's complicated, but they use hypergamy. They just say, oh, women are, you know, everything's, you know, they label everything hypergamy, right? Like they would say that if a very good looking guy who has no money is dating a girl who has more money but is less good looking, that's hypergamy. But they would also say it's hypergamy when the girl's good looking and the guy's not, but the guy has more money. And if you say both of those things are hypergamy, well, then logically we could flip it and we could say that men are hypergamous using the same data points. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the flip is this, the flip is the same. Now you're describing the same two relationships, just sex reversed. So you could use the same data points to create the same argument. So, you know, they're not particularly, I mean, a lot of them just aren't particularly clever. And so they say very silly things.
What do you think, this might not pertain specifically to research, but personally, what do you think kind of drives this sort of thinking when it comes to like dating and stuff like that, like with the people in this group, like in terms of they need to establish very strict, like rigid rules, and then they usually draw from like pseudo psychological like evidence, or like I know that they usually turn to like dating apps, like surveys on dating apps, but like dating apps aren't really like a great representation of reality. Like what do you think is driving that? Like is it just like it's just the ambiguity of dating is kind of scary? Or like because it's an
why
entire
are they
industry.
Interested in dating? Why are they interested in dating? I mean, I'm interested in dating app data as well. I think there are some things we can learn about it, but you're asking why they're interested in dating?
Why they're interested in specifically approaching it in a very like mathematical way, like very just like the way that they always explain things is very black and white, very there's no ambiguity. The way that you're discussing things now is like very academic because you understand that there's exceptions and that there's there's some sort of harm to like generalizations and stuff like that. But then there is also kind of like normal distributions and you can kind of generally say things, but they really want to jump onto like there is no ambiguity and things are the way they are and it's very black and white.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that a lot of them just dislike women, frankly. I mean, sometimes it's that simple. Like and so they want to make, because they don't make generalizations about men the same way. Right. Like they say all women cheat, or they imply strongly that like all women would cheat if they have the chance, despite the fact that men are usually in most studies twice as likely to cheat as women. But they never say, oh, all men helplessly cheat. Right. They treat men. The fundamental problem is that in terms of the generalizations is that they treat men with nuance. They treat men as nuanced human beings, and then they treat women as like, it's almost like they're talking about a different species of animal that has no free will. Like even in the topic of hypergamy, they'll talk about them being helplessly hypergamous, right? They'll talk about them, you know, basically they'll act as if every woman would trade up to immediately given the chance instinctively, right? And it's like, okay, that's not true. But
is there something in research on this, like regarding kind of when one sex dehumanizes the other sex, or like, because I mean, there's like objectification in sex, in sexual relationships in general, but like to this degree, like, is there an explanation for specifically why that is? Like, yeah, they hate women, but like, but then also there's so much value attached to kind of access, I guess, to women.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the funny thing, isn't it? I saw a clip of Destiny pointing out that it's funny how they hate women, they hate women, they hate women, but at the end of the day, the best validation they can get is women liking them.
Mm-hmm.
They all need to be, you know, in photos with women, in videos with women, surrounded by women constantly, because, mm-hmm. you know, that as much as they dislike them, that's, you know, the kind of final currency for them. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be honest, I'm not an anthropologist of the red pill. I mean, I don't really like thinking about them as a group that much. I am actually I did sign up to do a paper. Well, that's anyway. But usually that's not something that I think about. I just think about the individual facts. Are they right? Are they wrong? As a group, it just seems like a group of men who maybe didn't succeed with women when they were younger, and that turned into bitterness and hatred. I mean, it's kind of the women are wicked when you're not wanted thing. I think a lot of these guys got cheated on, a lot of them got rejected, and then it just completely broke their brains, I guess. Or maybe they were already on that kind of wave, and then they just started cherry picking evidence and creating a narrative in which women are evil and men are the heroes or whatever. And it's like, okay, cool. I mean, we've all gone through heartbreak. And I mean, if we're going to talk about just masculinity, since they're obsessed about that, I think it's a lot more manly to be able to get over it and still be a productive member of society instead of talking into a microphone all day about how much you hate women.
It's well said. Well, then to move back to your area of research, I am curious about some insights you've had regarding online dating. Is there any kind of evidence to suggest that online dating has somehow affected romance in the modern age, and you know, how we view the dating pool and how we engage in dating behavior?
There are other people who are doing better work on this and understand it better, but I'll just say this. One thing that I was discussing with one of my colleagues here in Australia, August Harrington, we were going over one thing that predicts relationship dissatisfaction is the availability of high quality alternatives. So if you're dating someone and they're not that great, but your second option, the other people you could date, they're just terrible, right? Then your relationship satisfaction will be very high. But if you're dating someone pretty good, right? And this is obviously, I'm speaking in generalizations. If you're dating someone pretty good, but you could trade to someone great, right? There are tons of great options that you have, and you've got someone pretty good, then your relationship dissatisfaction, that's going to predict lower relationship happiness. So what do dating apps do in the context of that knowledge? Well, they liquidate the market, right? They lubricate the market, I should say, by making it possible for everyone to access more options, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm speaking very speculatively, but it is interesting to think that the fact that there are now apps that one can put on your phone to replace your boyfriend or replace your girlfriend in a moment's notice, it's hard to imagine that that does good things to our brains in terms of relationship satisfaction. I also suspect, and I don't know this, but I suspect that these apps are designed to be continued to use, right? And so they seem to be gaming people's attention. They don't seem to be in the business of getting people married. And in many of these apps, I don't think that's what they even pretend is their goal. But in some of them, it is. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on dating apps. I think that I know of some great couples that have met on dating apps. And I also think that in some ways, they're probably quite good. I've never used one. So I don't really have any personal insights there. But I think that they've probably done some good, but they've probably overall done some bad. They certainly haven't done what some of these, and I say this without not even in a disparaging way, some people who are involuntarily celibate, right? Some people who are incels, they seem to think that dating apps just are the cause of all their woes. I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think that mating has always been hard for a certain group of men in society, and the same men suffering now probably would have been suffering from that condition, you know, 30 years ago. So
that's interesting. I guess another question I had regarding the research is, because this comes up a lot in just casual conversation. I'm in Montreal, so it's like very common. There's a lot of like polygamous couples, polyamorous couples, like open relationships. What is the sort of evidence in regards to how monogamous humans really are? Like, how cultural is it? How biological? Like, it's obviously a big question, but just in your area of research.
I would say that serial monogamy coupled with occasional infidelity is pretty clearly the default state of humanity, in as much as we have one. So the vast majority of people live in monogamous cultures, and even in cultures that permit polyandry and polygamy, the vast majority of people engage in monogamous relationships. If we were talking about any other species of animal, that would be the end of the discussion. If I was talking about penguins, right? And I was like, oh, look, all of the emperor penguins are engaged in monogamy or serial monogamy or seasonal monogamy or whatever that specific species does. Almost all of them are doing that. Then we would just say, okay, that species, you know, socially monogamous or whatever. With humans, almost all of us are doing that. And then we're still hemming and hawing about, oh, what's natural? What do we naturally do? And it's like, look at what we do, right? And then also we see that we have a lot of biological correlates of, we have reduced sexual dimorphism, right? Which seems to be correlated with monogamy. For what it's worth, our testicle size has shrunk pretty dramatically over the past. I can explain why that's relevant. It's a little bit graphic, but that's an indication that there's been a trend towards monogamy. Our canines have shrunk, but also just our weaponry in general seems to have dissipated. Males have much less capacity for violence than our more apish ancestors. All of that is correlated with a shift towards monogamy. Now, when I say monogamy, I mean social monogamy. I mean the illusion of one person at a time. Obviously, tons of people have affairs. I would say that most men cheat at some point, and many, if not most, women cheat on someone at some point. So that's what we are. I mean, we pair up for the most part. I mean, obviously there are exceptions. Obviously there's tremendous social and ecological diversity that leads to different behaviors circumstantially. But the overall pattern of humans, the overall tendency seems to be serial monogamy with occasional infidelity. And we have psychological adaptations to this as well. When you fall in love, right, you tend to focus on one person, right? It's not many of us have the experience of being in love with multiple people at one time. I'm not saying it's not possible, right? Love is a few different brain systems and they can be activated for different people simultaneously. But for the most part, yeah. And then when we look at jealousy again, it's like, if we're naturally polyamorous, why did every culture coincidentally invent the emotion? If you can even invent an emotion of jealousy, of sexual jealousy. So, yeah, I mean, I wish them well for sure. I mean, I understand that monogamy is difficult. Polyamory seems to have its own challenges, but they're definitely swimming upstream a little bit in terms of human nature.
What do you mean by that? Just that they can kind of adapt the infidelities that are very consistent in couples.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it infidelity. It seems like they're just doing multiple mating. Infidelity kind of implies a betrayal of trust. Hmm. And that doesn't seem to be the case with a polyamorous relationship. I mean, it's going to be different for different people, but it seems that most polyamorous people have to do a little bit of psychological jujitsu on themselves to stop themselves from being jealous and stop themselves from mate guarding and that kind of thing. And others seem to take to it more naturally. I mean, human variation is tremendous, but for the vast majority of people, the jealousy is going to be intolerable. And also for a huge portion of people, the basic inclination is going to be they want one person. I mean, certainly in my life, I've never been in love with multiple people at one time, right? So some people have that experience. I've never had it. I'm sure it's physically possible, but I think for most people, it doesn't seem to be the norm. So, I'm not anti-polyamory. Do whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Natural doesn't mean good. Maybe polyamory is better, right? Like there are plenty of things that are unnatural that are better. And this goes back to the warfare thing. I'm kind of worried now that people are going to clip that and make me sound like I'm like some psychopath who endorses war. I'm not. I mean, grow up. But I'm just saying that there's some evolutionary contribution. Like I think that fist fighting is probably natural to an extent. That doesn't mean that I think fist fighting should be legal or good, right? It's actually very, very bad. I also think that modern medicine is unnatural, but I think modern medicine is pretty, pretty good. Like it's kind of helpful sometimes, I would say. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm saying monogamy is our natural state, at least social serial monogamy, coupled with occasional infidelity, doesn't mean that I think that that's the optimum human behavior for happiness. I'm just saying that that's the situation we're in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wish them well. Maybe they can figure out a better gig.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess now to move on to more kind of practical topics, I kind of want to just ask you broadly advice you have for people who want to increase their chances in terms of mate attraction, in trying to be as inclusive as possible. I mean, there's a lot of different orientations and different people that are identifying differently. But I guess just in general, I'm assuming most of the research aligns with heterosexual couples, like men and women.
But a lot of it's going to apply still. I mean, my basic advice is to raise your mate value, right? Don't focus on, chasing and finding the right person. Focus on building yourself into the most attractive mate possible. And this is something that, I'm certainly not the first person to say that. It's very common advice from all sorts of people who are, interested in this topic. So it's just about making yourself more attractive to the opposite sex. And you can whine about what the opposite sex wants, or whine about what the same sex wants, right? But the basic principle is like, you complaining about the rules isn't going to change the game, right? There are some things that are attractive. There are some things that are unattractive, right? What's a good example of this? Okay, so for example, we talked about resources earlier. Men with more resources are more attractive. I'm not a particularly wealthy guy, right? Academia isn't known for its mansions, right? I can't sit here and complain and be like, oh, women should want broke guys like myself, right? They should be into broke guys. No, can't do that. I can either accept that I'm not perfectly catering to the opposite sex's standards, or I can adjust my behavior. Same thing goes. I mean, you can definitely improve your physical attractiveness. For most people in the West, this will involve putting on a little bit more muscle and losing a bit of fat, as well as being extremely hygienic and well-groomed and wearing clothes that are clean, fit, and match, right? That sums up a huge portion. I mean, I could go into high detail about how to improve your looks, but that would cover a huge portion of just the basics. But the basic principle of like make yourself look as good as possible, and then be pleasant interpersonally, that covers a lot of it.
I mean,
frankly, some of it is just going to be genetic. Like some people are going to be held back by their looks, but I would say most people haven't maxed out their physical attractiveness.
No, because I am interested in also the, because there is one thing about it is somewhat easy to adjust the appearance, but then how do you, I guess, sustain a romantic partner? So how what's the research in regards to being pleasant or the sort of social characteristics that somebody has where they're able to maintain successful relationships? Because also I feel like most dating advice is about getting as many partners or as much interest as possible. Yeah. And it prioritizes quantity over quality.
Yeah. And honestly, that's the easy part, mate. Like attracting someone is easy. It's keeping them that's difficult. I mean, some people say the opposite. Some people say the opposite. So I'm probably biased by my own personal experience of dating. Cause the attraction part is all this superficial stuff. And then the retention part now, you know, that's when it becomes a bit of a negotiation. It's like, how do we build a life together that works? Some basic advice on that would be to compliment more than you criticize, right? This is coming from Helen Fisher, who's the world's most cited expert on romantic love. And I believe she is the chief science advisor at Match. Anyway, we had a conversation a while ago and I basically asked her the same question. So I'll just kind of pass on some of her advice. Compliment a lot more than you criticize. Compliments seem to reduce stress and also make both of you feel more bonded. Something counterintuitive is that when you tell someone a compliment, it makes you feel good as well, makes you feel good about them. So that's kind of a relationship reinforcement tool. Another relationship reinforcement tool is non-escalative physical touch, right? So, I'm speaking like such a dork about this. I'm just saying that like, you know, when they're in the kitchen cooking something or you're in the kitchen cooking something, if the other person, you know, gives a little peck on the cheek or whatever, that's a positive optional activity that will make everything better. It's not leading to sex, right? You guys are just hanging out. You know, when you guys are on the couch watching TV, actually cuddling instead of, you know, just sitting within an inch of each other, that's good. That's a good thing to do. It seems to promote stable relationships. And then also, having sex, frankly. It's again, just from a research perspective, that's really predictive of healthy relationships. And so it should be. I mean, why? The whole point of a romantic relationship, in some sense, is from an evolutionary perspective, it's reproductive. And so our brains really, it would be kind of peculiar if they were able to easily maintain them in the absence of reproductive behavior with that person. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So having sex, having good sex, that's important. And then also incorporating novelty into your life. Generally trying to make sure that you don't fall into the routine. It's counterintuitive because there's a real pull to the routine, but trying to keep things happy and spiced up and fun, and you know, going on a little trip, going on a vacation, going to a new restaurant instead of the restaurant that you always go to. Those sorts of activities, they really seem to help with making people more satisfied in their relationship and kind of rekindling some of the new feelings. And then also incorporating spontaneity and surprise into the relationship. That's the flip side of the same coin. So to summarize, if you want to have a good romantic relationship, and so much of my advice would be specific to someone's situation, but general advice that I would say to literally everybody, have more sex, right? Do more new stuff. Touch each other in a comforting, non-sexual way on a regular basis. Compliment more than you criticize. More in general. Yeah. You'd be surprised how far those things go. Another thing would be to actually help each other out and support each other. don't think about, this is something that's somewhat research supported, is the idea that you shouldn't think of it as like, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. You should just go all in, right? And actually try to help and support mm-hmm. them without thinking of it as a balanced scale.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of people, they start to keep a tally in their head of all the things they did for their partner and all the things their partner did for them. And they're only happy if it's even or favored towards them. And it's like, okay, good luck with that, bro. You know,
it's a little too calculated.
That's just designed to start stupid arguments over mm-hmm. everything. So that way of thinking about relationships, it's just designed to end in tears. But
mm-hmm. So I have one last question, and it's kind of regarding, okay, so you were able to attract a partner, you were able to have some sort of relationship, and then there's a breakup. What does the research suggest in regards to dealing with like heartache, breakups? Like, are there some effective strategies? Are there certain just personalities that do better? Is there a gender difference, which we kind of already discussed?
Yeah, there does seem to be a gender difference where women seem to have a harder time, but some research goes the other way. There's some kind of pilot evidence that maybe even though women suffer more from a breakup, they move on more finally, but I don't really put much weight in that. And I don't think the gender differences are big enough to be worth talking about. I think it's hard on both sexes. I'm not aware of any research supported advice for how to move past a breakup. I apologize. I hope you haven't gone through one recently. That would be unfortunate if you were hoping that I'd have something to share with you. And I don't want to just pretend to know about things I don't know about. I do know that in a therapeutic context, it's sometimes recommended to just remove yourself completely, to, you know, no contact. And in some cases, you know, if you need to change jobs, to stop seeing them, change jobs, that kind of thing. There does seem to be an out of sight, out of mind element to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that if you're going through a really hard breakup and they're not coming back, then yeah, the folk wisdom, and in some cases therapeutic wisdom, of like, remove yourself, no contact, that probably would hasten things up. But I don't know if there's been a study, like, that's what you would really need for me to talk about that topic the way I talk about other topics. You know, you'd really need a study where it's like one group does no contact and one group stays friends. Then you see who has better emotional outcomes in the long term, short term, medium, intermediate term. And I don't know if anyone who's done that research, but it's possible they have. Yeah, I'll look into it after I get off the call.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, then I'll give you like one last kind of bonus question. Is what's your kind of most surprising or most interesting kind of piece of research or study that you've encountered since you began looking into human dating behavior?
Well, that's the funny thing, is that in my field, very few things are counterintuitive because we're humans, right? Like if penguins were studying penguins, if ducks were studying ducks, it would be, imagine, you know, a group of duck scientists, they're running studies on ducks, and then the finding comes out and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe we do this, right? Like that would be surprising. So we don't get a lot of counterintuitive findings in my field. I guess one finding that seems to shock other people is the idea that behaviors, romantic behaviors, such as divorce, such as infidelity, they do seem to have a genetic component. So, and that's, you know, that's been teased out in twin studies and things like that. So I would say that usually when I say that on a podcast, people are like, what? No, that's crazy. And so that's one that's relatively surprising.
Yeah. Because there is that like once a cheater, always a cheater kind of.
And there's some truth to that. I mean, if someone cheated in their last relationship, they're three times more likely to cheat in their next relationship, according to one study. But the question is like, does that apply? I mean, does that translate beyond that study, number one? And then also three times more likely isn't 100% surety, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, yes, I would say it's a red flag if someone's cheated in the past, but it's you can't hang your hat on it. People change.
Right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
It was super interesting. You guys can check out Mackin's podcast Species, and I'll put the link in the description, everything. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.